Welcome back again to Bad Quaker Podcast, where liberty is our mission. This podcast is for December 25th, 2012, and it's podcast number 253. And I'm very pleased today to have with me T. Hunt Tooley, professor of history and chair of the history department at Austin College in Sherman, Texas. He's an adjunct faculty member of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. And you can find his articles at the Mises.org site or at lewrockwell.com. And he has some really good articles over at the Independent Institute as well. Hunt specializes in modern European history. Hunt, thank you very much for coming on the show with me today.
Ben, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Before we really get rolling today on the Christmas truce, which is what we wanted to talk about, specifically with this being a Christmas broadcast, Hunt, you know, I was reading the book Mises, the last Night of Liberty, and I don't know if you've read that or not, but it describes the world in Europe as being so much different prior to the Great War, prior to World War One. The emperor in Austria would just ride into town in a carriage, and you would just see him, you know, on the street like a regular person. There was no security. There was, you could travel all over Europe without passports and all kinds of paperwork. And you wrote about that in your book, The Western Front: Battle for a Battleground and Home Front in the First World War. But if you could describe for us what the world was like in Europe before that war, I would appreciate it.
You know, there's one passage that strikes me from a famous art critic and historian who wrote that that the period before the war was for him a time of sweetness. He said there's a kind of sweetness of life that I wouldn't give, I wouldn't take anything for. He said I wouldn't take all of our telephones and our movies and our radios. I mean, he's writing this in the 40s or 50s. So in a way, when I think of this period, then I think of this this sweetness. Now, there were a lot of counterindications, and life could be tough then as it can be tough now. And, you know, there are all those issues. But there is this kind of special moment. And in fact, in European history, they used to call this La Belle Époque, the beautiful period of time when, you know, there was just a public sense of, I don't know, involvement in the culture, high culture and low culture, both flourished and appealed to individuals in a lot of different ways. I mean, we think about the popular songs of that period. And the greatest of the World War One songs were those that were rooted in that culture, like Long Way to Tipperary and all those. So it was just a time in which freedom flourished. You know, there's a good, if I can go on for just a moment, there's a good passage in The Last Night of Liberalism where Guido Hülsmann discusses this whole period, as you say, and this is a very special kind of time in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Historians have talked a lot about political problems and the nationalism that arose in the empire and the ethnic disputes that happened, and of course there was a lot of problem in the royal family, the Habsburg family, too, a series of deaths, and the empress was assassinated and so forth and so on. But as far as the way that people lived, it's just remarkable. I mean, as Mises pointed out on many occasions, Europe couldn't have waged this war with these huge costs if the free market hadn't supplied an enormous material basis before the war. That's what the war was eating away at. But you take Mises' family, who were Jewish, they had been ennobled for just contributing to society in many ways. And so really interesting picture of a society that's open, that people can move up in, that's tolerant. As you suggest, Ben, it was a very special time in the history of the world, I think.
Europe had gone through about a 35 or 40 year period of peace there, which was kind of unusual for Europe, but they had also had this huge explosion of wealth and prosperity because of, you know, the what we might term the Industrial Revolution was really rolling there in the late 1800s. And that wealth was not just concentrated in the super rich, though. It was everybody was prospering from that, right?
Yeah, I think by all the measures that you can consult. I mean, infant mortality rates were down. Lifespan was longer, diets were bad. By all of these things, life was getting better all up and down. And again, this is not to say that there weren't people who had a hard time. I mean, if you read some of those workers' memoirs, for example, a number of German socialist politicians later wrote their memoirs and commented on their childhood. And, life could be very, very rough. And again, it can be very rough now, as we all know. But some of these, I remember one in particular, one I'm thinking about, where this person who later became a prominent German politician, talked about how he and his brother would sleep in the attic, and it was unheated in this Berlin five-story walk up, and they walked up even one more story to sleep at night. So, I mean, you know, they kind of slung a bunk up there. But you know, I don't get a sense in his memoir that even in this working-class family that had cramped quarters in a big family in maybe one or two rooms, that they thought of this as absolute privation or anything. So, yeah, I think it was up and down the line, and I think the middle class was extremely prosperous. People saved a lot of what they made. Working class, too, saved a lot of what they made. So, yeah, it was a time in Europe and in the United States when a lot of things were changing. But on the whole, it's very correct. There's this enormous wealth creation that happened because of these wonderful operations of the free market.
And you've talked also about, you know, how there were a lot of people in Germany that came across and worked in England and didn't necessarily, you know, the citizenship issues weren't exactly what they are today. And so then all of a sudden there was this shift and governments began wanting to make lists of people and so forth.
Exactly. That's exactly right. In fact, I recently begun work on a project on enemy aliens in the war. There always had been a category of enemy aliens, and people during the Napoleonic Wars might be put under house arrest or something like that. You know, there were measures that were taken to ensure that enemy aliens either got home or still maintained contact, could be fed, that kind of thing. But there was no sense that because if you were at war with, say, France, that you should somehow punish or persecute those people who are French, who happen to be in your country. But, you know, in a way, the whole run-up of statism in the period before World War I, this particular stage of the state and so forth, is really an exercise in identifying enemies, by finding enemies, and of course, then if we project that a little bit farther, then and you look at the real doctrines that emerge from World War I, especially the totalitarian ones, then what would Marxism, Leninism be, or Bolshevism be, except a search for enemies? And what would, obviously, what would National Socialism be, except a search for enemies, and of course a successful finding of the enemies as well. So, yeah, that this whole enemies business is important, but the enemy alien situation gives it illustrates exactly what you're talking about. The as I've run across these records, for example, in England, German craftsmen finding a job in London, maybe around 1900, they didn't bother. There was a naturalization process, but frankly, nobody thought it was necessary. Some of these people, many of these individuals, say from Germany or Austria, set up shop, married an English girl, had English kids, and then found themselves in 1914 or 1915 thrown into an internment camp in the wilds of the Isle of Man in the middle of the Irish Sea. It's not that wild a place, but the camp was in a wild place. So, in any case, this could happen and did happen to many, many people. But yeah, it was the period before the war. They didn't give it much thought. People just went to where they needed to go to work, and there was no such thing as a passport or anything like that.
Let's talk about the Isle of Man there for a minute, because you know, a lot of people of my generation recognize it as a place where some really, really great rock and roll concerts took place or whatever. But that was there was a nasty concentration camp there that kind of set the precedent for more of the same but worse, wasn't there?
Yeah, and I would they collected about 30,000 enemy aliens and put them in this camp first in the hotels. I mean, the earliest camps actually were a little bit posh. The Isle of Man is this fascinating island. As you say, it's famous for a lot of things. It's do you know it's got the oldest motorcycle race in the world, and it still goes. It's one of the few off-road motorcycle races, the Touring Trophy Race, the TT, and it's got all kinds of interesting things. And of course, it's a bit of a tax haven because it is technically part of the UK, but technically partly not. And is not a member of the European Union, though it belongs to the UK, has its own currency. But so the Isle of Man is a wonderful and interesting place. Before World War One, it was an enormous a vacation spot. They had developed the beaches around Douglas and other places, and there were a number of interesting sites, and the countryside was gorgeous. And they had some races. They built I don't want to overdo that. But when the war happened, of course, the Archduke was assassinated on June 28th. The July crisis leads up to the war, and so on August 4th, everybody's pretty much in the war. Britain declares war that day, and that's just at the beginning of the vacation season in the Isle of Man, and so people who were going to set off from Liverpool for just a two-hour packet ride across the Irish Sea to the Isle of Man, they all canceled. So you can see how this shapes up. Your whole life is the hotel and the food and the attractions and so forth. And so they had these places empty, these hotels empty. But then they built this grim camp on the western side of the island, and just overlooking some cliffs on some meadowlands there. And they set up shop, just plunking these people, most of them productive men, you know, from ages, say, 20, 25 to 50 or 60. And these people had nothing to do except to read the letters from their families about how they were sinking into destitution. So, yeah, their food was plain, but it was okay. Actually, the person who did the most to alleviate the situation in that camp was a man named Bailey, who was a Quaker, and did spectacular work wheedling his way into the official structure and getting himself named industrial commander or industrial leader of the camp. And he was especially concerned that these internees who just had nothing to do each day, that they would have workshops to do woodwork, to make furniture, that he would scrounge around for shipments of lumber and things like that, that they could use in these workshops, and give people something to do. And he also served as a go-between between oftentimes between them and their family to promote this to enable the families to visit this far off location during wartime, etc. So in the end, this camp is certainly the beginning of something really important. But it starts out slowly. It's not even as bad as the concentration camps the British had set up for a different purpose, really, but with the same sense of incarceration in the South African War in 1900. So, yeah, this is all part of the history of what I guess you could call it the prisoner state, where you identify enemies and put them into prison and or worse, but you certainly put them into prison as one of the means of the states fighting all these various hordes of enemies that it identifies in our modern times.
I'll just tease one more time about the Christmas truce. When we come back from the break, that'll be the thing that we talk about the most. But before we go to that break, you touched on something there in South Africa with the Boer Wars, and it's hardly ever talked about that I've seen the importance of the Boer Wars in building up the animosity between the English Crown and Germany in laying the foundation for some anger there that England maybe wanted to take out on the Germans in World War One.
Yeah, I think so. I think the Boer War started. It was technically the one we're talking about, as you say, there is more than one war. But the second Boer War started in 1899 was a matter of a couple of Boer republics, of Afrikaner republics that had just detached themselves. I mean, people went into land that was not claimed by anybody except by some actually black African groups. And the Boers had been in Africa for several hundred years themselves, their families, of course. But they had taken over these, they had settled in these areas inland and called themselves republics and set up their government. But, of course, gold and diamonds were discovered there. So the British moved from their bases, which they controlled on the coast, Cape Town and so forth, and attacked to try to make sure that they had control. Of course, Cecil Rhodes was very much in evidence in that. Also, the head of the Beers Diamond interest. So there's this war, and of course, the concentration camps emerged in the midst of that as a means of getting these Boer commandos to come out of the woods and stop shooting British troops. They just took the family members and put them in camps and allowed nature to take its course with little food and exposure and so forth. And by the way, they also took the black Africans, many of the farm workers and surrounding Africans who just got in the way of the British army. There were also camps for them. I guess they were separate but unequal. They were even worse than the camps for the white Boers. But in the midst of this, of course, the German Kaiser, Wilhelm II, Kaiser Bill, whom we all love to hate, he expressed congratulations expressed congratulations to the Boer president in one of the little raids that was a run-up to the war. And the war itself demonstrated, as you say, there was a lot of German sympathy with these Boer settlers. Now, this is not to say that the Germans were much better or any better as colonial masters, and they did some dastardly things themselves. But in this way, the imperial situation this was one of the many ways in which imperialism kind of provided a lead up to the war.
When we get back from this break, we're going to start talking about the Christmas truce, and Hunt is going to describe for us what I believe to be, or what I feel, in my opinion, to be the most amazing moment in history. Stick with us. We'll be right back. And thanks for sticking with us through the break. This is Ben Stone with Hunt Tooley, professor of history at Austin College in Sherman, Texas. And and we're going to talk about the Christmas truce. And I think it's one of the things in history that it's starting to catch on recently. More and more people are hearing about it. But I think a lot of people still have no idea what the Christmas truce was, what led up to it. And you know, it's anticlimactic ending in a way. But Hunt, why don't you go ahead and tell us basically the story of the Christmas truce?
Sure, Ben. In brief, this this Christmas truce, there were several Christmas truces throughout the war, but the most important one and the one we think of as the Christmas truce occurred on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, 1914. I just draw everyone's attention to the fact that the war had started in August, that the very first phases of the war on the Western Front, and that is to say in Belgium and France, involved the movement of the German Schlieffenplan troops moving in. The French opposed, the Belgians opposed, the British brought the BEF over. And so there had been this this war of movement, these really huge battles. And once the German Schlieffenplan failed, the Germans dropped, they went to plan two, which was to drop back. And I say that ironically, they really didn't have a plan two, but their alternate plan was to drop back behind the fighting lines and site strong points in the rear of the lines. And so then the French and the British attacked, and the Germans withdrew to these strong positions, trenches with concrete pillboxes and things like that, strong points. So this meant that the British and the French and the Belgian army was in it too, were attacking mostly strong points. So the Germans kind of plunked themselves down. At the time, they talked about a race to the sea because some parts of that line were formed first, and they tried to go end around and kind of do an end run, but both sides. But neither succeeded, and these battles, as they got into September and October, became only more and more fierce. And the trenches became more and more an idea. I mean, a lot of people had predicted that the war would be a real storm of steel, a real a kind of new sort of battlefield that nobody could live on for very long. And that had been sort of predicted. But in fact, the soldiers were still fighting in the old ways, and the armies were still organized to have troops stand up and sort of march in bunches across to the other side to attack. And that was, with the new weapons, just suicidal. So millions of casualties occurred in the first phases of World War One that didn't occur later on. Even though the weapons got worse, the trenches actually protected people. But this trench front formed 400 miles from the sea to the Swiss border. And along this front, it got to be by October a stalemate. So it's just a stalemate where in these trench systems, and they're very extensive and very very much a network of trenches, not a single trench at all, but many interlocking trenches on either side, of course, separated by this no man's land, which could vary. And this is a really important point for listeners and for people interested in the Christmas truce. They were separated at some points by as much as 200 yards, sometimes even more. But at many of the points where the line stabilized face to face with the opposite line, the distance was less, sometimes much less, sometimes incomprehensibly less. There were places on the Western Front where the opposite trench lines went through the same building or house. There were places on the Western Front where, for example, there's a spot in France, a tiny little battlefield park exists there today, a place called Vauquois. And there the French and the Germans fought each other on top of this ridge, sort of from different sides of this little village. And they were literally within an easy stone's throw, the kind of stone's throw that I could still make easily. So people were close by sometimes in these situations, and that's a really important thing to think about in these when we talk about the Christmas truce. That this had shaped up as a stalemate, but on the other hand, the soldiers were in proximity, and at the same time, they had experienced huge losses. A lot of their friends had been killed in action, and yet the high commands were nowhere to be seen. The ones ordering the attacks were nowhere to be seen. And well, I think we can talk more about that in a moment.
And that was part of the reason why that they were able to accomplish the kind of activity that went on during the truce was that, you know, they were literally almost within talking distance of each other. And then in addition to that, you know, like we were talking about it before the break, there wasn't all that much dividing these people. We're not talking about governments. We're talking about the actual soldiers.
Yes.
There really wasn't that much dividing them to begin with. I mean, slight language differences, but they were all pretty much the same religion. They all had similar traditions and ties to each other and families living in each other's countries and so forth.
That's an excellent point. They weren't divided by much of no man's land, and they weren't divided by these other things either. You know, there's a case, one of the witnesses of the Christmas truce who left an account of it, one of the participants in it, mentions that there was in one case a chef on the German side who had been a chef at at one of the restaurants at the Trocadero in London before the war. And he was delighted to see some of his former patrons at the restaurant in no man's land on the day of the Christmas truce. So there were enormous cultural ties, and the mere fact of these enemy aliens we've discussed. Yeah, I mean, in essence, what happens is that these ties, the kind you mentioned, the geography of these trenches put the soldiers in a real proximity. And in the lead up to December, things had gotten slightly more comfortable. This is also an interesting thing that might not occur to you, but to occur to somebody who's studying this, and that is that the ground froze pretty solid during the last days of November, and especially around Ypres, which is in Belgium, and it's low-lying. The water table is very shallow in that area, and so that's the muddiest of all the Western Front places. And when the ground froze, we might think, oh, the poor soldiers are shivering in the trenches. Well, they could put on clothes, but they couldn't avoid that mud, except when it froze. So there's actually a way to walk across and to walk onto no man's land at that point fairly easily on the frozen ground. That's important. But so there had been some overtures during this period. Life was a little bit more comfortable. Some soldiers, I think, had the feeling in the week before Christmas that the battle would be the armies traditionally had gone into sort of winter quarters, and they felt something like that, and so they began to shout across, and they began to some German soldiers put candles up on the side of their trenches, and then they began to serenade each other in the day or two before Christmas Eve. The German soldiers singing that great German song, Silent Night, Stille Nacht, and Austrian German, I should say. But and then British soldiers would serenade in return with some British carols. So there's that kind of thing going on. And then on Christmas Day, there were some quite explicit truces made among the soldiers. And they, in some cases, the truces had to do with burying the dead, a truce to just go out and pick up the bodies that had been in no man's land and unreachable. In some cases, these burials led to other kinds of human contact in no man's land. In some cases, there were no burials arranged. It was just that soldiers on either side began to shout out, we want to come over and we've got tobacco. Do you have tinned beef? Things like that. And so this grew to a fairly large gathering around Ypres, and also this kind of truce broke out at numerous other places on the Western Front because everybody's experiencing a similar kind of thing. It didn't happen everywhere. That could depend on the local commander and again the local geography of the trenches. I mean, you have to envision that this can only happen with a certain distance and a certain width of no man's land, so to speak. And so that is an important part of it. But where soldiers could contact each other in one way or the other, and there are a lot of ways to do that, but where they could, they seem to have done it, and this was fairly widespread. And the officers were, I think, in most cases, pretty much involved, or they didn't allow it to happen. I mean, in some places, officers did not allow this to happen, but the high commands had nothing, absolutely, of course, nothing to do with it. In fact, they were on the opposite end of the spectrum. This went on over Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and then in a kind of communication, they went back to the war. So this is what we think of as the Christmas truce. That's the sort of basic picture of it.
And it should be emphasized, you mentioned that, but it should be emphasized that the higher command, not only did they not authorize this, at first they didn't necessarily understand how widespread it was, and then when they did understand, they wanted to immediately take measures to stop it, because this was a truce happening on the soldier level, not on the diplomatic level.
Oh, that's absolutely the case. The general most involved in the biggest outbreak of the truce in the 1914 Christmas truce was a general named Dorian Smith, and he was furious that this had happened. There's an old idea that many of the officers were cashiered or fired or broken or whatever in the wake of this, and that's not really the case. But it is true that many of these officers got direct orders, and of course across the division, Dorian Smith and other divisional commanders across the front gave out specific orders that this was not to happen again. I mean, you know, this goes against everything that the high commands, as agents of the state, I mean, as direct agents of the state, wanted to happen. They had to have the aggression high. They had to have, this was in their minds, a danger of the proximity of the lines that they had to fight against. And I think this Christmas truce made them realize, I mean, think of it, it had just stabilized, the lines had just stabilized during October. So we're really talking about 7 or 8 weeks worth of stalemate, and the high commands are just now realizing the danger of this kind of proximity, of putting a huge numbers of soldiers, the majority of whom were working class, in proximity to each other. They thought, well, this is a problem. So they adopted all kinds of, I mean, they could order people not to do truces, but that's not all that, it might not be all that effective. So in the wake of this, and in the wake of understanding that other truces were going on too, through 1915 and on through the war, the high commands began to introduce new weapon systems or new weapons into the weapon system that had really no military purpose at all. For example, early in the war, you know, there'd be in a division only two or three snipers. There's a lot of talk today about, and it's sort of romanticization of snipers. But if you think about it, was any war ever won by a sniper? Was any battle ever really changed by a sniper? I suppose there might have been some odd case where this happened, but basically, sniping just keeps the other side really, really mad. I mean, and when they're really, really mad, then they respond and attack and shoot back and all that, and it keeps the aggression high. Same way with trench mortars. This was a known weapon at the beginning of the war, but there were only a few per regiment. But the high commands began to mandate that there would be more trench mortars. These were little teams of three men who would have a carryable small mortar, broke into three pieces with the ammo, and that team would appear in the trenches and just, fire a dozen rounds or 20 rounds across no man's land at the enemy, then pack up and go away. Well, naturally, these teams were hated by the soldiers because whenever they fired, the trench mortar teams would fire at the enemy lines across the way, then the enemy would respond, but they would respond to the spot from where the firing had come. So the trench mortars didn't do anything. I mean, it didn't change the shape of the Western Front. There was never any idea of breakthrough or even really attrition. I mean, if it killed 10 or 12 soldiers on the other side, that's meaningless in the terms of these millions of troops who are on the ground. I mean, it's not even a drop in the bucket. But these were meant to keep the aggression high and to kind of do away with this natural affinity that the soldiers on the front had for each other on the opposite sides of the line. Other weapons too, the trench. There's a rifle, a grenade teams, and numerous others. And then the more and more throughout the war, increasingly every half year of the war, all the high commands put out orders to carry out more trench raids, more midnight patrols in no man's land, more of these types of things that really didn't do much in a military sense at all. But they did keep the aggression high. So the high command understood what was happening and tried to counteract it that way.
So it was basically harassing fire or harassment fire then.
Exactly, yeah. You know, there were many more kinds of the Christmas truce is a part of a general pattern. And there's a wonderful book from the early 80s by Tony Ashworth called Trench Warfare. And it's about what the soldiers call the live and let live system. And of course, the Christmas truce is the most explicit kind of truce. But Ashworth, a British sociologist, discussed from the memoirs and diaries and eyewitness accounts, he discussed the extent to which there were often informal truces on the Western Front. He calculated that nearly at a given time, only about half of the front was attacking and the other half was engaged in some kind of informal situation. And by that, I mean a truce where maybe we don't shell the enemies. We can actually see the enemy's latrine, but we don't call in artillery fire on it. And then we set ours up at a convenient place and the enemy can see that and they don't shoot at that. And so people are able to go to the latrine without being fired on. And it's just a kind of informal thing. There's a lot of nonverbal communication going on there in one way or the other. Or trench patrols that keep to a certain circuit that don't disturb anything in no man's land, and the other guys don't shoot at them, thinking, well, it's just their patrol they've been ordered to go on to. Why kill them if we don't have to? So there are many of these informal truces, as Ashworth shows in his wonderful book, and they took place throughout the war. And so once again, this is the Christmas truces, all of the informal truces. I see these, and I believe Ashworth does too, and many other observers, of course, and see these as a way of individuals taking control of their lives. I mean, we get the sense that there's the state and that there are all these haggard soldiers that the state, forced into oblivion, and this is certainly an element of it. But a lot of people fought back, and in the end, tried to survive, tried to help their comrades survive. Understood that the war was a rotten business. Understood that they could make peace with their opposite numbers across the way, while their countries, for reasons totally unrelated to any individual good in the country, were waging this huge war. So So the Christmas truce certainly falls into that kind of pattern.
Folks, stick with us. In about a minute, we'll be right back with more with Hunt Tooley and with the Bad Quaker podcast. Thank you. And thanks for sticking with me through the commercial break. Ben Stone with Hunt Tooley on the Bad Quaker podcast. And Hunt, one of the things that struck me odd was reports of soccer games breaking out between the opposing teams. Between the opposing armies. And I can't help but wonder if when they divided up the teams, if they actually divided up Germans against English or Germans against French, or if they also divided them up and said, hey, you know, we want Hans over here and you take this guy over there. And, you know, it would be interesting to look back and see that.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes you wonder if they had a choosing up sides the way we used to do on the playground at school. But, you know, I think and that's actually a really good question. It makes you wonder how organized these things were. The accounts that I've read tend in the direction of, in fact, there's several that use the word free for all. So it may have been that they just, kind of kicked the soccer ball around a little bit among each other. But it could be that they organized games, because there's some accounts that make it seem like there was a more organized system. It's hard to know, and it's hard to know the extent of organization. One reason I think it probably militated against a real any kind of prim organized game was that they were, after all, in no man's land, and even at this period, early in the war, the no man's lands were all pitted with shell holes and whatnot. Not nearly as much as later, but at this point, it would have been pretty uneven ground to play a soccer game on, but who knows? I mean, it may well have happened. And of course, there's so many situations, and each little part of the front, people described it. A man named an officer named Robert Andrews wrote an interesting account from actually the 1915 truce. There was actually, for all the pressure from above, there was a 1915 truce in some places. And indeed, a 1916 truce. But Andrews describes looking to the right and left, and he said, I don't know how extensive this truce was in 1915, but I looked up and down the line, and as far as I could see, there were soldiers out in no man's land from both sides. So I think a lot of things happened really fast. I think some guys, imagine that, having your soccer ball with you on the Western Front. I mean, it makes you wonder in those cases who said, well, I think this time I go to the front line trenches, I'll bring my soccer ball with me. But they did a lot of other things, too. The famous cartoonist Bruce Bairnsfeather said wrote in his memoirs that he went out and saw a German a German officer, and he pointed at his buttons, and the officer allowed him to cut off a couple of buttons, and Bairnsfeather cut off a couple of his own buttons, and they swapped buttons. A lot of people swapping food. Sometimes there were singing parties out there too. So there's a lot of interaction that happened very fast. You can see how dangerous this would be for these individuals just willy-nilly becoming friendly with each other. You can see how this must have been anathema to the high commands.
You know, throwing out that old phrase that war is the health of the state. And one of the many aspects of ways that that's true is that during the war, you know, those actual soldiers that are out there doing the deeds themselves, the high command tends to think of them in more mechanical ways, like they are just puppets, just pawns to be pushed back and forth. I'm sure they don't intentionally want to lose any more than they have to, but they still don't really think of them in a human way. But yet, when you see something like the story of these truces, what you're really looking at is just, you know, coming at it from an anarcho-capitalist point of view, you're looking at anarchy taking place in a situation that is supposed to be the height of state control, and yet right there in its heart, when the state is at its most powerful moment, it can't control human nature.
Oh, I think that's an excellent point. Yeah. And it's a hopeful point as well. Imagine all these guys freewheeling, and many of the officers too. I'm sure in some areas, you know, these prim officers didn't take part. But yeah, this whole thing smacks of all kinds of individual initiative and even indeed free exchange in the middle of no man's land. That's just fascinating. In this, so you kind of get these Lockean soldiers in the midst of what is a supremely Hobbesian world. It's a very interesting thing to think about. You know, there were also I should mention that there are also Christmas truces and informal truces in other theaters as well. I like to talk about the Western Front the most because that's sort of my favorite part of it. But there were Russian informal truces and indeed Christmas truces, especially where Ukrainians were. Think of the music that must have come from those trenches.
Wow.
Yeah, a real singing. And then, of course, there were truces even up in the Alpine settings of the Italian, Austrian front and so forth and so on. So this was a pretty widespread phenomenon. And I mean, as you suggest, it's a human phenomenon. It's an individual phenomenon, and a wonderful thing to think about. I mean, there are not many hopeful moments in a statist exercise like this, but this certainly produces one, doesn't it?
There was, I'm particular battles don't come to mind, but it sticks in my head that there were several accounts during the Lincoln's War of Aggression, the so-called Civil War, where Northern and Southern troops faced off each other like in a similar situation and ended up being very friendly with each other, you know, in the off moments when they weren't actually killing each other.
Yeah, I think so. And in fact, there's a lot of lot of accounts of soldiers shouting across at each other and having good natured sort of poking fun at each other and yelling, hey, you Indiana fellers, what do you think of this? And, things like that. So, there's a time or two where a stray cow gets loose between the Confederate and Union armies, and they halt for a moment while somebody tries to run it down. And everybody's cheering to see which way the cow will run. So, yeah, I mean, this is a part of even that war, which certainly had its stationary moments as well. So it's a very interesting phenomenon, really is.
Contrast that to, you know, if you think about the future and the horrible mess we're in. Well, I'm not over there. I know you're not over there, but in Afghanistan and what's going on in the other countries over there, where somebody sits at a desk in Arizona or in Nevada and flies basically a computer program to a dot on a map and pushes a button, and then he doesn't have the same personal impact as to what's going on, and he never hears the voices of those people and never sees them eye to eye. And it's really disturbing to think forward and just imagine what the world could be like if this kind of nonsense continues.
That's exactly right. I think that it's just hard to imagine that this is happening, and yet it happens every single day now, this killing from a distance. And of course, all the bombing exercises since the 1940s have been killing from a distance, and it's a very kind of depersonalized phenomenon. I remember a German friend of mine who actually experienced the war on the Eastern Front in Germany himself once told me, a very dear friend of mine once told me that he was in the 1970s in a group of American visitors to Germany. And these men were actually many of them, they were there partly on an Air Force kind of reunion or something for veterans. And these Americans had talked about how the surface of the city looked as they bombed it, and they kind of laughed and joked about how it looked like black tar boiling when they dropped so many incendiary bombs on this particular city. And my friend said that he and his German fellows, I mean, they didn't make a big deal of it, but they all just kind of looked at each other as if to say, don't they know that there were people in that boiling surface of the earth that they had just bombed into oblivion? Don't they understand that you know, it wasn't just an impersonal exercise? So I think that's a part of it. And this is the part of the Western Front to understand this geography is again important, that when you get human beings into actual contact with each other, that there is, you know, aggressions occur. I mean, there are, what does Locke call them? There inconveniences occur, but on the other hand, people can find out ways to get along rationally and psychologically and make that work.
You know, you mentioned the Air Force there. The difference in the World War I and World War II from an air battle perspective, in the early part of World War I, the pilots would literally carry sidearms with them and lean out the cockpit and shoot with their pistol at the other guy because they hadn't actually figured out how to attach guns to the early planes. And the, you know, what we see like with Charlie Brown and Snoopy flying his Sopwith Camel, that all came later in the war. In the early part of the war, the air parts of the battle were very personal between pilots. And by that, you get this high level of appreciation for your opponent. But all that was gone by World War II. You know, it was just a matter of firebombing a city, and, you know, the destruction was in a completely different category.
Absolutely, yes. It's absolutely true. These flyers in World War I regard each other as individuals, and sometimes even recognized each other from the air. But in the ensuing wars, the distances get greater, and the animosity gets greater, and the dehumanization gets greater. NPR had a report on not long ago about a case where a German fighter pilot zeroing in on a wounded American bomber actually decided that the bomber was totally crippled, and so why kill everybody in it? And so he escorted them over the German coastal batteries to try to help them get back home, and I think they ultimately did get back home. And ultimately, the pilot of the American bomber years later located almost miraculously located the German fighter pilot who had let them live, and they became close friends. So, but that's an extraordinary case, and that's what's so interesting about it. Whereas in World War I, this happened from time to time, that people would refrain from pulling the trigger if somebody was wounded and could limp home, etc. So, it hadn't reached that level of depersonalization and vilification and hatred yet. You know, as the distances gets greater, I often think of Orwell's description in 1984 of these wars of the future, which always take place off someplace else. There are always wars for resources. They're always depersonalized. I mean, in people, the 3 minutes hate sessions are the only ways that people know who we're fighting. And of course, that changes pretty often, too. And one week, this group are the horrific villains, and they're led by some horrific villain. And then the next week, it's somebody else. And I often think that Orwell was amazingly prescient. He's just describing our current situation to the T.
And since we early on, since we talked about what life was like before World War I in Europe, specifically in Austria and Germany and so forth, how would you describe the change that took place after World War I and the, you know, the horrible upsets with the economic? Everybody pretty much nowadays knows about the economic upsets with the Weimar Republic. But what was everyday life like, and how did it change from pre-war to post-war?
Well, for one, that's an excellent question. I mean, it's for one thing, people were poorer. For one thing, a few war profiteers, that is to say, in rent seeking industries who had managed to use the state to kill off their business rivals and win big. Apart from these tycoons who had made war profits, people were poorer. In other words, all this transfer, this huge transfer of wealth through higher taxes, through defaulted loans, government war bonds that the government never paid, but above all through inflation. This transfer of wealth took place and just basically altered the standard of living of society, so that people in all the European countries were poorer. And to some extent, of course, in the United States as well, although that's not apparent because we got into the war late and there's this kind of lag. We had a material basis that was far greater than any of the European countries to begin with, because by the time of the war, the United States had already been the leading commercial country in the world, the leading economy in the world for nearly two decades. So, but. For the European countries, winners and losers, life was more grim, especially among the losers. But life was more grim wherever you looked. I mean, you don't have to be in the new founded Bolshevik Russia to find that life is not what it was. There's just not that level of comfort, nor is there a level of civility, because there's a blowback then, too. We talk about a blowback today from the American attacks on people all over the world. And we say that you really can't have this situation without bringing the violence, the brutality back home. And this is certainly what happened in World War I. There were more, for example, there were more serial killers. There were more sex crimes. There were more murders. After the war, societies were just altered in all kinds of ways, culturally and economically and so forth. Again, here's a bright spot. It's an interesting spot, and I think that somehow the individual maintained a kind of place in all this, because after the war, one thing that happens is that the very kinds of truces that we've talked about have engendered a distrust of government that did not exist before. I think to a large extent, the National Socialists, in other words, the Nazis in Germany and numerous other parties both the right and the left were able to recruit their members, not necessarily because those members believed in every part of the Nazi Party platform, but because people were so disaffected after the experience of the war. In other words, the government is inexplicably ordering us to die in these mass charges. And that just doesn't stand to reason. There's got to be some other explanation. And this led to all kinds of ideas about why this had happened, all ideas about conspiracies, Jewish conspiracies, Jesuit conspiracies, ideas about this. And these are all just attempts to explain this inexplicable war on the part of individual people. Sometimes people who didn't have a very clear view of what they were trying to piece together, but still in all, individuals attempting to make some sense out of what is out of the agenda of the state.
And in an attempt to try to leave this on a positive note, if there's anything good that can come out of the Afghan, you know, Iraq situation that's going on over there, I have seen a lot of soldiers coming back that all of a sudden say, you know, I was really all gung-ho for this in the beginning, and now I see I see it through a different set of eyes, and a lot of them are coming into the liberty movement through that awareness. So as horrible as the current situation might be,
yes.
If we can leave the podcast on a positive light, that's maybe a lesson starting with the Christmas truce, but or maybe even before that, but for the individual soldiers to see the con that war really is.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you can even make that go one step farther and talk about the where we're attempting to go next in Iran, and to think about the representation of Iranians, who are a wonderful, on the whole, a wonderful people. The sort of birth, Persia is the birthplace of culture and courtesy and so forth and so on. People with much to recommend them, who are then vilified in the press in the run up to some kind of attack. I mean, you see this whole thing happening again. But I hope that realization, as with the realization you're talking about, that war is this kind of con game, and that individuals are individuals wherever they happen to live.
Hunt, thank you very much for coming on the show with me. And like we had talked about, I'd sure like to have you back on, and we can talk about a couple of other situations. One being the Lincoln's War of Aggression, and I'd also like to talk to you about the Middle East and the dividing of the Middle East after World War I. But thank you very much for coming on the show with me today. Be sure and get over to badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thank you very much, Hunt.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it, Ben.